Hello and welcome to the Money Marketing Podcast. I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager. And for this week's weekend essay, we have Amanda Newman-Smith, feature writer at Money Marketing, letting us know why it is important for everyone to get involved in intergenerational financial planning and why it's not just for the wealthy. Take it away, Amanda.
Intergenerational financial planning is not just for the wealthy. I used to think estate planning and stuff about inheritance was only for wealthy people. People like the clients Dan, my husband, has worked with in recent years. Dan is in construction and has been involved in several luxury housing projects for wealthy clients. One was for a Formula One racing driver who installed a real racing car as a centrepiece on one floor in the house. This sounded over the top to me, but it was the client's money to enjoy as he pleased, and he certainly had enough space for it. Then there were two sisters who had decided to move in together. They thought nothing of spending £1,000 a roll on wallpaper and thousands of pounds on a set of champagne flutes. My favourite was the young Saudi prince who was redeveloping a penthouse. In his own country, he was the equivalent of Prince Harry before all the PR blunders. There, he couldn't go anywhere without being recognised and mobbed by crowds who wanted a piece of him. But in Knightsbridge, you'd find him quietly hanging out in a local pub, casually dressed in a polo shirt and just blending in. He loved the anonymity he got in London and came across as an ordinary man who happened to have more money than most. The need for people like this to consider who will inherit their wealth seems obvious to me. As high net worth or ultra high net worth clients in some cases, leaving a lot of surplus wealth when they pass away is pretty much a given. That surplus wealth will need a new home one day because you can't take it with you when you die. Estate planning is very practical for people like this, especially as everything they do seems to have tax implications. Tax planning will always appeal to high net worth clients because without it, they stand to lose a lot of their wealth to the tax system. It's a great hook for advisors to hang their services on and prove their value to wealthier clients who can easily afford advice. I think what we're now referring to as intergenerational financial planning is also perfect for showcasing holistic financial planning. Deciding who should inherit, how much they should get, when they should have it, and how best to set it all up involves practical and emotional decisions informed by legal and technical knowledge. Isn't that a perfect fit for an advisor? It was interesting to read a story that Money Marketing ran early this month about a survey from the financial research firm, AKG, which looked at advisors' views on intergenerational financial planning. It found 54% of advisors felt demand for intergenerational planning had grown in the past year, and 88% expected the demand to rise over the next 5 years. Given what I've been hearing about COVID-19 making people more aware of their mortality and the need to make financial plans before they go, that doesn't surprise me. But I do wonder if that demand will come from the people who already know the value of financial advice. People with more modest wealth, those who would not describe themselves as wealthy, also need help with these sorts of things. But perhaps because of the association with estate planning and tax planning for the wealthier sections of society, they don't consider intergenerational financial advice as something for ordinary people like them, or they are put off by the real or perceived cost and bumble along, not really understanding the potential implications of doing nothing about their will and estate. Advisors who do a lot of intergenerational wealth planning have told me that people are great at making the grand gesture to their children that one day this will all be yours. But unless they have a will and have expressly stated their wishes, they can't assume that their assets, however small, will pass to their chosen loved ones in the way they want. When I was a baby, my granddad and great uncle lost out on what should have been their inheritance because their mum, who had remarried when they were young, hadn't made a will. She wasn't wealthy as an advisor would understand it, but the house she and her husband lived in was owned outright, and they were okay financially. Suffering a stroke took its toll on her health, and sadly, she passed away when I was a few months old. She'd always promised her boys the house when she was gone. I'm not sure if she expected to survive her husband or just didn't know how these things worked, so assumed it would automatically pass to her children. But with no will in place and their stepdad still living in the house, their mother's wish was never granted. To cut a long story short, my granddad's stepdad remarried. His new wife didn't fancy playing happy families with her husband's stepfamily, so the old ties were cut quite abruptly. The house was sold and they moved away, leaving my granddad and great uncle with nothing. Handy as it would have been for my granddad, he was never bothered about the money. It was the loss of that family relationship and the impact it had on my youngest aunt that was hard to take. I vaguely remember that when my granddad's stepdad passed away, my family received an invitation to the funeral in the post. It was civil, but the line in the sand had been drawn many years earlier, and it stayed that way. This all happened years ago, so curious, I wanted to check what the situation is now. According to the government's website, if someone dies without making a will, and there is a living spouse or civil partner, they receive all of the deceased estate up to the value of £270,000. If the estate is above that, the first £270,000 and all personal possessions, whatever the value, goes to the spouse or civil partner, along with half the remaining assets. The other half of the remaining assets will be split between the deceased children, or if they are also dead, their children will inherit that share of the assets. I think if more ordinary people considered the possibility that the legacy they want to leave could end up going elsewhere, as in my family's case, they'd be more receptive to taking advice and not see intergenerational wealth planning as only for the well-off. There are more people living in different types of families now, and they may have different legal rights to inherit. Some couples aren't married, so they don't have an automatic right to inherit from their partners. Some people are part of step-family arrangements, which is relevant because stepchildren do not have the same rights to inherit as natural adopted children. The problem is people can't see that just because they're on good terms with partners, parents or other family members now, that might not always be the case. It can seem inconceivable, but you never know what's around the corner or how someone's death might change the dynamics of relationships between the surviving family members. I suppose in my great-grandmother's mind, the family unit of herself, the children and her husband was so strong that she never imagined it would be any different. Why would she? Within my own extended family, there is a core of people who remain close no matter what. But beyond that, others come and go. People have divorced or fallen out with members of the core group, brought people into the family that others don't gel with, or moved out of the area of work or to follow a partner who lives elsewhere. All of that loosens ties with the core group to varying degrees, causing allegiances to change and different parts of the family to break off and branch out. Not every week, but you notice it over longer time periods. So even if someone can smugly say they've sorted out their will, there's a need to keep on top of that network of changing relationships and make sure it reflects their current situation. It might even make sense to give some people their inheritance early, and getting advice can make a big difference to everyone concerned. It did in my case. My in-laws had a share of a property originally owned by Dan's late grandfather, which was sold around the time we were buying our current home. Rather than creating a potential inheritance tax liability for us further down the line, my in-laws gifted some money to us while they were still in good health to benefit from the 7-year rule. That was 8 years ago, and they've seen how their contribution to a house deposit has made a difference. It meant we were able to skip a rung up the property ladder and buy a forever home with a deposit of almost half the purchase price. I think the danger of all those "all this will be yours" conversations is that they happen without reference to advice and the necessary steps to make it a reality aren't made. That messes with people's expectations when they realise it isn't as clear-cut as they were led to believe. However distasteful it might seem to think about spending an inheritance you're not going to get until someone is dead, people do. They base concrete plans on having that money at some point in the future. It can come as a real shock for them to find out they're not going to get the windfall they've been banking on when a parent, grandparent or other relative dies. I know someone whose relative's death was financially messy, with debts to repay, and probate took forever. All this aggravation prolonged the most difficult phase of the grieving process for some beneficiaries, who hadn't been prepared for how long it would drag on and how quickly the cost would mount up. If the deceased had taken some much-needed advice and had a financial plan, all that hassle and expense could have been avoided. Unfortunately, it wasn't something she would ever have considered. To everyone else, she seemed to have everything in hand financially, but her death showed that wasn't the case. Some people are in a completely different situation where they don't have a family, so perhaps making a will and financial planning around that doesn't figure in their financial thinking. I remember watching the BBC series Hair Hunters some years back. It followed a team of probate researchers who needed to trace missing or unknown heirs before a deceased estate legally passed to the Treasury. I'm sure as a viewer I was supposed to think how marvellous it was that the deceased's wealth was passed into a descendant rather than a big, bad tax man, but I didn't. I was depressed at how someone's life savings ended up funding the lifestyle of someone they'd never known or at best had only seen a handful of times as a child. I don't think blood is thicker than water when it comes to this. Surely there'd have been more worthy candidates, such as the deceased's favourite charity, than a stranger loosely described as family. A good financial advisor would have been able to sort that out. I'm glad I know plenty.
Thank you once again, Amanda, for another enlightening weekend essay. We also thank you for listening to this weekend's podcast. If you would like to keep up to date with all of our new content and podcasts, please do so by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else that you get your podcasts from. You can also follow us on Twitter and LinkedIn, and of course, get all of the latest from the Money Marketing website. See you next time.